Hello, and welcome to Drunken Lullabies Presents My Personal Mixtape. Joining me this week is solo artist Alex Deason, also former lead singer of the band The Damwells. We had a great conversation about the 10 songs that were selected to share with you today. We start with The Damwells era and work our way up to a song that just came out a mere month ago. So, without any further ado, here's my conversation with Alex Deason. Welcome to Drunken Lullabies Presents My Personal Mixtape. Joining me today is Alex Deason, formerly of The Damwells, and we are here to talk all about his songs and his personal mixtape. The concept of this show is to sit with a musician and have them select 10 of their favorite songs from their career, ones that they feel the most proud of and want to showcase. Alex and I did a collaboration for this episode. He selected 5, I selected 5, and now we're going to put our lists together and discuss what we selected.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Dude, thank you for joining me. You actually were previously featured on the original show, Drunken Lullabies, as a band of the week when the last Damwells record came out. And we featured some of your songs and was going to have you on when your solo albums were starting to come out. But then I stopped doing Drunken Lullabies, so we never got around to it. So,
well, there you go. Well, I'm glad to be here now. It's
cool to have a new project and have you be a part of that. So, the first song that we picked is actually mine. I put them in chronological order just to kind of make the story flow a little bit better rather than jumping around and having this be a time travel episode. So, the first song is the debut single, Sleep Singing, from the PMR Plus One EP, which was self-released back in 2003, I think?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay. I've got a copy that is, it's not one of the hand-stamped ones that I think Ted was responsible for making. But yeah, this was the first piece of music you guys put out as a band and made a music video that involved you having a lot of shit thrown on you.
Yeah.
And having to sing backwards, I believe.
Yeah, I had to learn the song backwards, yeah.
How'd that work out?
I don't know if it... I mean, I guess it worked out fine. I mean, it was certainly weird to take your own song, which had English words, and then kind of try to like sing it in another language. I mean, that's essentially what it was like. It was like singing it in another language.
Use your phonics, knowledge from grade school, and just try to sound it out as best you can.
Right.
So this song, like I said, it was a lot of people's first introduction to the band. With it being 17 years old now, do you still look back fondly on this song, or are you kind of over it at this point?
I guess I'm over it. I don't look back on it. So I don't, I mean, I'm looking back on it now because you've asked me.
Sure.
and I'm feeling fondness for it. The experience of making the video was actually a lot of fun. It was like the first, you know, like real thing that the band got to do.
Sure.
Other than, you know, like sticking stickers to street corners and handing out flyers and, you know, hand stamping CDs and stuff like that. And it was the first like non-DIY thing that we did, which felt a little bit like a, you know, like a victory of sorts. But yeah, so I think back on it fondly right now.
Were the other guys in the band the ones throwing the crap all over you during the...
Oh, yeah.
I kind of figured.
Yeah, it was them. It was the film crew that was there, which I think they were called House or something like that, HAUS. But they were doing it, and yeah, it was gross.
This was also re-released on the next full length, which was Bastards of the Beat. Did you guys use the same exact recording? Did you?
Yeah.
I was going to say it sounded pretty much identical, but I wasn't sure if any extra polish was put on the full length version. Because I love the, I guess, the intimacy of your vocal track. You know, at the beginning, you can, you know, hear you breathing.
It's up to you now. This place is filling up with smoke, and you won't let me breathe in or out. So I resolve to cut my own throat.
I just always enjoyed that. I try to listen to as much music on headphones as possible these days.
Oh, good. And yeah, everyone should do that.
Yeah, that's where you get those subtle little nuances. And there's actually several of those moments in a lot of these songs that we're going to discuss.
Myself alone. Each day you bring me closer to going.
After sleep singing, we're going to move on to another one of my picks, which is from the Bastards of the Beat album that I mentioned. Now, this was on Sixth Man originally, but then you guys signed to Sony and they re-released it, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
What You Get is, it's just one of my favorite songs on that album. It's just a really good rock song. It really showcases the band and just that, I don't know, that rockin' damn well sound.
Do what you wanna do. Say what you wanna say.
I do enjoy there's some yelling and screaming on the background vocals that like way under in the mix. But again, if you listen on the headphones, you get that. Who's doing those?
It's me and Ted and our old manager, Wes Kidd, who was in a band from Chicago called Triple Fast Action in the 90s.
Yeah.
And he's the one that's doing this super high one.
Okay.
Which was amazing. He was the lead singer of his band, but... it's like a total Alice Cooper, actually I don't even know if Alice Cooper's the right reference, but it's like a total like heavy metal kind of moment, which are very rare. Actually, in Damwell's catalog, in fact, I think that's the only time that we ever got one of those.
So yeah, it's a super quick, you know, in and out rock song. It, aside from the short song Assholes, it's what kicks off the record. And we can get into the Sony thing, but honestly, I'm just going to tell everybody, go watch the Golden Days documentary. It's actually on YouTube now, isn't it?
Yeah, we just put it up there for free. Or we didn't. The director did, Chris Sikorsky. He was kind enough to do that.
Yeah, you guys were in a deal with Sony, got stuck in developmental hell over the course of a year and a half in this documentary, which did win some awards, chronicles that whole ordeal and leads to the release of the next album, Air Stereo, which is where your first pick comes from. Song number 3, which is Louisville.
Yeah.
So this record ended up being picked up on Rounder in 2006, I believe.
Yep.
I never wanted to get you down, start you up. I tried to bet on your winsome frown, sad Irish look. I never thought you would wake me up, take me out. I wanted to feel anything from you, even a handsome doubt. All I wanted was going home. All I gave.
You do pronounce it Louisville, not Louisville, which I feel is a much better choice on your part for melody purposes.
Right, yeah. I got a lot of shit for it, though.
I can imagine, because God forbid you go down there and call it Louisville. So yeah, singing it in a song, but they have to get it. It doesn't sound nearly as pretty when you're just saying Louisville over and over.
That's right. I tried to explain that on the microphone at a show in Louisville one time, and I don't think anyone really appreciated it very much.
So this is kind of the first beautiful kind of somber song that we will feature on this show. You're really good at writing those, and why is Louisville your first pick on the list?
Well, first of all, thank you for the compliment. It's very nice. And I think because the chorus doesn't ever seem to like, it's like it felt to me like a meditative chorus. Like these chords are just kind of going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth over this melody that doesn't really change very much. And I don't know why I'm just attracted to that kind of harmonic relationship in songs, but it always feels like, you know, that it's just the anticipation of something that's almost never fulfilled is kind of what makes it exciting to me, I guess. Which is, I don't know, isn't that how life works?
I wanted to get you down, I'll start you up. You know you could turn my luck around with a touch. All I wanted was going home. All they gave me was Louisville. I don't want love or conquer Rome. Just your voice and a sleeping pill. Louisville.
We were stuck in Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't want to be there. And I was just kind of saying, you know, I don't need any kind of major, you know, like Titanic-esque love story. I just want to go home.
Ironic you say Titanic. We will come to that later.
Oh, yeah, right.
We shift from the Air Stereo record, and we move on to the One Last Century album, which this was self-released.
Right.
You kind of were like, screw it, we're going to do it ourselves, and...
Well, no, we got dropped from the label. We had no choice.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So this.
No, I think that it's very easy to like paint totally insignificant historical events with like some sort of, you know, rose-colored you know, brush or whatever. But no, we got dropped from our label because we were not a viable commodity to them, and we still wanted to make a record.
Mm-hmm.
So we did.
So this was released 2009, given away as a free download on the website, I think.
Yeah, we actually did it through Paste Magazine's website, which was really cool. They partnered up with us and featured it on their site.
This song is Bastard of Midnight. This was actually my introduction to the Damwells. I was in a mix CD trading group and with a bunch of other music fans, and we would do these concepts and themes, and then we would, you know, make like 10 copies and mail them to each other. Like, it kicked off that mix CD, and I don't think I made it to track two for a good 10 or 15 minutes. I just kept hitting rewind every time this song ended. Could not get enough of it. It was just an insatiable hook. I was like, I need to buy everything these guys have done. And I did.
Oh, cool. Thanks, man.
Hey, what's your number, Chicago? What time is it in Japan? I've got something to offer. It's never been in demand. Yeah, I got something to say to you that I know you'd rather ignore. I am the bastard of midnight. I might just sleep outside this door. Trouble keeps the bar lights on for the heartache. She said Sunset Boulevard will take me home, but I just wanna scream.
Master to Midnight, I know it is kind of a favorite of a lot of people's. This was this made without the other members of the band? Because I know Jay Barkley's playing guitar on this track.
Yeah, it was. It was made without, I think Ted, it was just me and Jay and some other people. That was when the band started to kind of go their separate ways. I think Steve Terry was, at that point, had left the band. I think Dave Chernus had also left the band. It was just me, and I think Ted was involved in some way, but he had this full-time job.
I think he plays on 55 Pictures, if I remember
okay,
right.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that makes sense. And actually, that was a song that I wrote with Steve Terry, the drummer.
Okay.
So actually, they are all on that record. In fact, I think every single Damwells record has at least one song where all four members are on it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so that's probably 55 Pictures is the song on that record where it's the original four.
And that was a near list maker for me, but I was trying to spread out the songs a little bit and fill in some gaps in the albums that were highlighting, and I could not leave Bastard of Midnight off of the list. So that's what I had to go for. But yeah, 55 Pictures is definitely a great track and should be checked out as well.
I thought about putting that on my list too, just because it was such a cool time to be, you know, when I wrote a song like with Steve and the band was sort of all involved together. It was a special moment. I think, you know, looking back now that the band is gone and, you know, we've all moved on to other things, the only things I look back on with any type of like real emotional significance are the times when the four of us, you know, got to do something that was really where we got to connect, you know, like moments on stage together, writing a song together, having a laugh, you know, like all the jokes and the stupid shit we did. And, you know, I don't think about like, you know, what I was thinking about when I wrote this song or that song. It's really more about like, you know, watching Dave Chernus walk into Guitar Center with like, you know, earplugs in his ears and like videotaping him, you know, trying to avoid all the shredding that was going on around him just so he could buy some picks, you know. You know, there was a lot of songs in the Damwells catalog that kind of came out quickly, mostly because the chords were like borrowed from another song or the like idea was borrowed from another song. And I think those chords, which if I'm remembering correctly, because I haven't played it in so long, it's like this sort of like the Bob Mould, Minneapolis, Paul Westerberg chord structures, at least the foundation of the chord structures that are like imprinted in my brain from listening to that music growing up. And whenever I revert to those chords, I always feel like songs come out really quickly.
That's what I think hooked me is I'm a huge Matt's fan, and the person who made that mix is as well. That was one of the bands we would always bond over. So it made perfect sense that she threw that on right at the beginning of a mix to send me. And,
oh, cool.
Yeah, and there we go. We move on to one of your picks, which is from the 2010 album No One Listens to the Band Anymore, which this had like a Pledge Music Kickstarter type of campaign, if I remember right.
Yeah, I think that was one of the first ones ever, actually.
I do remember donating and supporting it and getting waiting.
Thank you.
In anticipation for that CD to arrive in the mail. I still need to track down some vinyl copies of some of the past releases. We've got Werewolves, which is like the first ballad off of that album, if I remember right.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So why is Werewolves your second pick?
I think it was because it was the first song that I wrote where I was definitely paying a lot more attention to what I was saying.
Okay.
You know, I think, I don't know, songwriters work all kinds of different ways, but a lot of times it's like, oh, you know, the words sing well. I actually kind of fucking hate that now when people say that, because it's just really just laziness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. I mean, or maybe it's not, whatever, who cares? I don't really have a horse in that race anymore, but I just felt like I wanted to tell a story. I wanted to still be, you know, I don't know, in the style that I liked, which is, you know, not being too specific about anything, but kind of painting an emotional picture. And I've labored over those lyrics for weeks, which I don't think I'd ever done before. Before that, I was like naively, I was of the Jack Kerouac school of like, you know, it's whatever I'm writing is from God's mouth to my ears, and I shouldn't, you know. Although I didn't say that to myself, but that was certainly what I thought. I mean, being in your 20s and in a rock and roll band on a major record label is like, you know, the deadly combination for some narcissism, which
sure.
I definitely suffered from. But I think at that time I was also in graduate school for English, and so I was thinking a lot about literature and, you know, reading a lot. And So I really labored over the lyrics, and I think that I also, you know, again, in the tradition of like borrowing chords and ideas, there is a chord in the song that I borrowed from a Wilco song, just like one chord in there, and it just seemed to tie the whole, you know, chordal structure of it together really nicely, and it felt like, yeah, I kind of was able to step away from it when it was done and feel like that was something new, and it was something that was bigger and better than what I'd done before.
Your heartbeats on the fault line of love and doubt and wasted time.
not here to show you up, break you down, or change your mind. There's nothing we haven't burned, but still this fire makes no light and no heat. I have been around the world, riding on the edge of something.
Ted was back on this whole album. He's his pictures in the liner notes. So it was the two of you as the Damn Wells, and then like session musicians.
Well, friends. I mean, we paid them for the sessions, but they weren't they weren't like strangers. The only person that wasn't like a sort of semi full-time member of the band was Matt Johnson, who played on a couple tracks, but he was actually an old friend. He played with my sister, but I mean everybody, you know, David Lamoureux, who played keyboards on a lot of this stuff and did a lot of arranging. Jay Barkley played guitar on a lot of stuff. Neil Ostrovsky was the producer. He played drums on a ton of it and, you know, gave a ton of like great engineering and production insight into it. Yeah, so it was really a group effort. I mean, it really was like we were all like hunkered down for, you know, days and sometimes weeks at a time, just trying to like get the songs together. And it was a cool experience. It was kind of like when we made Air Stereo.
You've been spinning here a while, down among the city lights. You shuffle through the bright streets of St. Petersburg, summer white night. Just wanna hold you up, face pressed to the velvet sky, so you can hear heaven answer every question you've ever had, save the ones you wanna need to ask.
Another headphone moment. You got those layered vocals on the third verse that kick in.
Yeah, that was really fun to record. We had a cool crew for that, and they all offered different bits of production kind of insight that I thought really made it, you know, cool.
Come and let us be against the tide we set so to. She might have a way out of here. She might have love.
We're going to stick with the same album for song number six, Still Off and No One Listens to the Band Anymore. This was my number five pick. It was battling with Texas, with Too Old to Die Young, but it won out, and it is Last Day of the New Age.
Let's make a deal that the end is the beginning, that any song on the radio is fine. I got a heart beating, breaking by design. Time is a trashy and taking forever. Let's make a deal that we all fall down together. It's the last day of the new age. There's nothing that I need, nothing to change. And all that once was one. Strange.
I just love this chorus. It is just what I call irresistible. It makes me smile. I love the arrangement. I was listening to it while I was mowing the yard earlier and was just out there in the backyard singing along with it. Sometimes that's all it takes with me. I appreciate, you know, lyrics and the craft. And when you compare that with a super catchy hook with the right pop sensibility, like, that's it. That's all it takes for me. Like, it's an earworm that I'll find myself humming, you know, randomly through the day after I've listened to it. So I don't know what your thoughts are on the song, but I really dig it.
Well, thanks, man. I mean, yeah, I like that song too. I think my issues with that song or other songs like it is that the chorus is falsetto, and I have a terrible falsetto. So when I do it on recording, it's easy because I can, you know, like, take as long as I want to
sure.
the right take. But performing it live was always really hard. And, you know, I always felt it was really important to try to, you know, when I'm performing these songs, you know, have the set list be great and all the songs feel confident about them. And, you know, we're lucky in that we had a lot of songs to choose from, so we didn't always have to play. I mean, some of these songs never got played live.
Yeah. Do you have one that you wrote and recorded on an album and you were immediately like, that's it. I'm never going to play that one live ever.
Oh, yeah. A bunch of them. I think we actually played every song from the record that we're talking about. No one listens to the band anymore because we had a show we played where we played all the songs. But
yeah, you did a YouTube stream thing too, where you played every song, you know, you had ever written. I remember watching that.
Yeah, but that was wild and
required a lot of homework.
Yeah, I mean, there's songs off records, like there's a song off the Last Animals record called Too Old to Die Young. We never played that live. There's another song called Down with the Ship. We never played that live. And I think it was like one of those things where we finished it in the studio and we're like, okay, that's cool. We'll never play that live.
You did what you needed to do. You got it on tape and it can just be enjoyed that way.
Yeah.
Now we have about a 5-year gap between Damwell's records, but you were keeping busy during this time. This is when you started putting out the solo EPs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
And those were, there was 4 of them in the series. Each had 3 to 4 songs on them, and you ended up using some of those songs for the next Damwell's record.
Yeah, that's right. I actually forgot about those EPs when I was making this list. Would have picked one from them.
which one do you think you would have picked?
God, I think I probably would have picked like death metal and disco.
Okay.
I think that's always like a crowd pleaser. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the first songs I wrote where I think people thought it was funny, you know?
Yeah, you do have a sense of humor, and it did kind of start coming out a lot more in this time frame. It seems more prevalent in your solo work than the band. So 2015, we have the final Damwell's record. This was put out on Rockridge, but you guys also did, I think, another Pledge.
We did, yeah.
Drive for this as well. And this is a song I chose. I remember the video for this song coming out, and this was one of my favorite records that year. And I picked the song Lost. Has nothing to do with the TV show. But the video features you and your lovely significant other, Amber, running around in black and white, looking very dramatic.
Yeah, I mean, it was, we had this guy named Rick Reef who offered to do the video for free, and he was like a major director, had directed like a bunch of, you know, big ad campaigns for different, like for BMW and stuff. And he was a big Damlos fan. He's like, hey, I want to make you guys a video and I'm willing to do it for free.
That's a tough sell. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Right. and he had this idea and it was very cinematic. And, I was like, yeah, sure. Let's do that. You know, that record too, that last Damlos record was a bit of a rebirth though. The sort of short lived, but it was kind of a rebirth for the band. So at that point I was like, yeah, sure. Like that sounds like a cool thing to do. Let's just do it and see what happens, you know? And I think it was received well, I guess. Isn't that the point? I think it worked. It worked well. It was definitely done well.
And you guys did have the four of you back together.
Yeah.
Now when you toured, I know Mike Dunn, another musician that, you know, has worked on a lot of different stuff over the years. He came in and played in the live band. I got to see you right. guys play in St. Louis and gave you the Co-op Records t-shirt that yes. I promised you. And I was always stoked when I would see you wearing it on Instagram. So
I still wear it.
The self-titled record, like I said, that was one of my, you know, favorite releases of 2015. And I was preparing to go to that concert in St. Louis. And I had just met this new girl and was kind of getting to know her. And, you know, music is kind of a big deal for me. So, you know, I always got to figure out, you know, what are their musical tastes and whatnot. And I mentioned I was going to see the Damwells, and I was like, you ever heard of them? And she's like, oh yeah, like I've kind of got a little bit of a crush on Alex. And the fact that she knew your name, like just at the mention of the band name, I'm like, okay, all right, she knows some stuff. So we bonded a little bit over your music, and now we're getting married in a matter of weeks. So yeah, thanks. Thanks for helping out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I get lost underneath the stars, waiting for the big bad wolf to come out. I get caught staring at the cars, looking out at all that red in the dark. There's just so much for me to take away from all the painted nights holding on to LA. But I just let these monsters take me away.
After this self-titled album comes out, you mentioned earlier it was a short-lived reunion because, you know, you make the social media post that the Damwells are officially done.
Right.
And moving forward, it will be just under your name and you start going to town releasing solo material.
Yeah. That's accurate.
Yeah. So the first self-titled album came out in 2016, written, performed, produced by you.
Right.
How liberating was that?
Yeah, very. Yeah, it was very liberating. That was, you know, I think that, like, I'm still really proud of that record. It was super liberating.
You were able to, explore some like soundscapes that, you know, maybe you couldn't do under the Damwell's name, and just did you have stuff already set aside, or did this just all come churning out kind of all at once?
It came out all at once. It was like a flood of inspiration. And no, there wasn't like I couldn't do those things with the Damwells. I mean, or maybe I couldn't, but there was certainly nothing preventing me from doing it other than, mm-hmm. I guess, my own perception of what the Damwells should be.
Okay.
So when I ventured into solo land, you know, I think just, you know, kind of like freeing myself of it allowed me to just sort of think differently, and yeah, it was just a flood of material just started coming out, and it was a really inspired time.
Well, one of the songs from that album, it was going to get discussed whether it was on your list or mine. It was going to be on this top 10, and that is A Little Less Like Hell.
I saw the interview. Guess it was okay. I laughed at the funny parts. Rogan can sell an asshole afar. The part where the dictator dies. To be honest, made me sad inside. Like when everyone broke into song. The day we killed Osama bin Laden. Now I understand. Ashes come down, but what I'll never understand is why, regardless of how hard we try, we meet somebody on the cross just to make up for the things we lost. Tell me who like hell.
A very poignant song written 4 years ago, and unfortunately still just as relevant as ever given what's going on in our country right now. But I mean, who are we kidding? This has been going on for, you know, decades. The song is just, it's filled with references of, you know, 9/11 and just racism towards President Obama. Eric Garner gets mentioned in one of the verses. Of course, the gentleman who first said, "I can't breathe," while a police officer had him pinned down, and
while a police officer murdered him.
Yeah, selling cigarettes, allegedly, which he, you know, denied. There's a lot going on there, and this was one of your picks. So, obviously, you're proud of, you know, what you were saying here as an artist.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not proud of it. I'm ashamed that I have to sing it. I'd rather sing about, you know, my daddy issues, you know, because that's what artists like to do. They like to talk about themselves and there's no denying that. That's just what art is. It's a, you know, it's an extension of the ego. But it's disgusting to have to sing about these things because they still exist, you know. I spent a lot of time doing activism in my new projects, which is a band called Broken Baby that I'm in with Amber, and working for a record label and running a record label. And, you know, we spent a lot of time doing activism for social justice, for...
awesome.
You know, and I think that was kind of the beginning of I mean, there was another song earlier in the Dan Wells catalog where we kind of talked about, sort of vaguely talked about political unrest. But I think that, you know, kind of zeroing in on, you know, the way that black and brown people are treated in America, specifically by the police and also by systemic racism, was something that started to become, you know, sadly, through my own privilege, I couldn't see it until, you know, it was far too late for so many, you know, of our brothers and sisters. But, you know, it was part of that time in my life, I think, when I sort of let go of the Damwells and I was inspired to write these new songs. And I started to become aware in fundamental ways of just how distorted reality or just how distorted the perception of reality is in America. You know, this is kind of the only, like, talking about songs, you know, like, that's fine. But talking about these issues, I think, is really the only thing I honestly care about anymore, because as a songwriter, I've kind of retired.
Mm-hmm.
I think of songwriting and writing songs as a tool of activism.
Okay.
I think of, you know, whether it's activism, you know, specifically for racial injustice, or whether it's, you know, trying to help offer something into the world that, you know, will relieve people of anxiety. You know, I think of songs like that. I don't think I'm going to sit down with a fancy producer in 10 years and write my country record.
Sure.
You know, that's not something that interests me. And I think that at that moment in my career, when I started writing those songs, A Little Less Like Hell and the songs from that album, it became very apparent to me that I had moved beyond a certain kind of songwriting, or at least I'd moved beyond a certain kind of songwriting that had no other intention other than to serve my own ego.
Okay.
So I think that was kind of the beginning of it. And I do consider myself a retired songwriter in that I don't write songs for my own sake. I mean, they wind up becoming, you know, sort of therapeutic, which I embrace,
mm-hmm.
You know, therapeutic for me. But I think the impetus for doing it is no longer I'm a songwriter, I need to write songs. And maybe that will change, but I think ultimately that was the song and the album where that fundamental shift first became apparent.
Okay. And it's one of those songs that musically, if you're not paying attention to, you know, the lyrics, and like we said, some people just, you know, have music on in the background and it's like, oh, this is kind of a, you know, funky, poppy, Fleetwood Mac-y type of vibe, and then you can't ignore the lyrics once you get to a certain part of the song, because if you weren't paying attention, you get slapped in the face with a word you don't hear in a lot of songs coming from, you know, a white musician. Obviously you're quoting.
That's right.
But there is an inward drop in there.
I watched Obama's speech on YouTube. I don't have TV. What he was asking for seemed to me to be pretty reasonable. When he was done, they clapped, which reminded me of watching C-SPAN in my mother's bed, 'cause she could keep the monsters out of my head. And I feel we've come a ways from Selma and those darker days, but it's so hard to forget the black man who was killed for selling cigarettes. And at the bottom of the YouTube page of Obama's speech, there were so many comments made, and more than four or five said they wish that nigger
I've always wondered, did you have reservation actually saying that in the song?
Yeah, of course. I still do. And I'm still not totally sure it was the right decision.
Okay.
You know, a lot of this whole process that I think many white Americans are going through, though painfully slow, is understanding, you know, fundamentally understanding the impact of white supremacy on black and brown people in America. And I think we understand it in the vague terms, like burning crosses and lynchings and, you know, and watching police murder, you know, Eric Gardner, or watching police officers murder George Floyd. You know, that's something that I think, you know, anybody with any type of empathy can understand and sure. get behind. But there's a big problem with white people in America, and it's whiteness. Whiteness is a disease, you know, and it blinds people from the ability to see and empathize on a much deeper level with what other people are going through. And that's a really big problem, because that is what systemic racism is. Mm-hmm. It's something where the machine keeps churning without your intercession. You don't need to be in the driver's seat. You know what I mean? We don't need to have, you know, so many people are, you know, focus their energies on Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a symptom
right.
of a system. You know, he is not the master pulling the levers. It will continue that way without him, just the same way that it continued when Obama was president.
Yeah.
You know, obviously to a much less obvious and brutal degree, but I think when I use that word, you know, again, I was quoting what I, you know, to give some reference, it's a part of the song where I'm talking about a speech that Obama gave, and it was on YouTube, and there were a bunch of comments, and the comments were, you know, horribly racist and terrible, and it was people who didn't hide their identities using the N-word against him. And I thought at the time, and I I'm sort of split about it, but I thought at the time that, because a lot of what I am trying to do is, you know, in making activism music, mm-hmm. is not trying to say to people, you need to do this, you need to go do this. I do say that occasionally with Broken Baby, because the sort of messaging of Broken Baby is different in that it's a more aggressive alternative punk band. But I think it's important to use manipulation in music to convince people that they should be paying attention to something, and then when they do, they have some sort of enlightenment.
Okay.
And I think what you said earlier is like you're right on the money. I used purposefully a style of music that I knew would be appealing to white people and to people who are probably not as engaged in politics as they should be, or rather in, you know, obvious empathetic issues that they should be, to get their attention so that they would put it on in the background and tap their foot or whatever. I mean, it's so vastly different from anything that I had done before in my catalog that, you know, I'm surprised that no one has uncovered this before. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it's such an obvious, and I've made no deception about borrowing from other artists. You know, and I mentioned before borrowing, you know, different kind of like chords or chordal sure. structures or tempos or ideas from, you know, like that is what songwriting
exactly.
is.
Exactly.
Not high art.
Right.
You know, it's not high art. So it's not like you're supposed to just come up with some sort of new, you know, kind of pop. It's all basically pop music, rock and roll or whatever. So what I was trying to do was to utilize that both in a conscious and subconscious way, but to utilize what I, you know, being a hack, I'm a hack. I can take something that someone has done and I can turn it into something that's new and my own thing. And I was like, you know, I'm pretty good at that. I'm going to use that in this capacity to make something that's, you know, sort of generically appealing in these ways that you mentioned, like, you know, Fleetwood Mac or whatever, mm-hmm. other music that appeals to white people, to have a message embedded in it and manipulate them into maybe coming to an understanding about something. And that's what I thought maybe the quoting that the N-word in from that YouTube thing, I thought that, you know, going that final distance and quoting that, you know, in much the same way that John Lennon said, you know, woman is the N-word of the world,
right.
you know, is to make people turn their heads and be like, what did he just say? Because I think that that's sadly the only way you're going to get people to engage sometimes in finding real empathy for taking up these issues. I mean, if somebody was standing on your fiance's neck,
right.
like we wouldn't be talking about it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
You would be protecting her with everything that you, you know, that you have at your disposal. So this is what I have at my disposal. You know, I don't know if I'd be much good in a fist fight against Derek Chauvin, but I can certainly try to write a song or affect change in the ways that I know how, with the, you know, the skills that I have. So that was really, you know, though maybe I wasn't totally aware of it at the time, that was the beginning of starting to understand what my future as a songwriter would be.
Yeah, well said.
Tell me who I've got to talk to.
We'll have a little bit of a palate cleanser here. We'll switch to a little lighter of a tone. You mentioned you may not be super good in a fight, which transitions perfectly into our next song, which is also off of the self-titled debut album. Leonardo is the song, and this was another one of your picks.
I think because it's a song about being a coward.
Okay.
I just think about all these songs like that, where they lionize, the singer lionizes him or herself, in mostly himself, in a way as to be the hero. Like I think of some of the songs growing up, like the bridge to, God, what's that song? I can't remember what it's called, but it's like the bridge goes, like a knight in shining armor from a long time of Peter Cetera.
Yeah, Peter Cetera, Gloria Love. Yeah.
Right. And I just think that when I first got to songwriting, I just sort of was emulating and copying and regurgitating the songs that had made me feel inspired. And that definitely made me feel inspired when I was a kid. I mean, you know, I think it was like in Karate Kid, and I wanted to be the Karate Kid, you know. So I think that dispelling some of the myth of what songs perpetrate was kind of what I was trying to do in that song. You know, my girlfriend is, you know, like her freebie is Leonardo DiCaprio, meaning like, you know, if Leonardo DiCaprio wanted to sleep with her, I have no, you know, I have to let her do it.
Right. Oh, fair point. Who's your freebie then?
Oh, well, mine was Kate Winslet, ironically, which is kind of what.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And
I think every couple does this.
Yeah.
Right. Mine's Anna Kendrick.
Oh, yeah.
And my fiance's is Paul Rudd. Oh. Which I'm okay with. Paul Rudd seems like a great guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, so, you know, it's like if it's got to be somebody else, at least it's somebody I seem to like.
Right. Yeah. So I think in that song, the chorus says this thing like about, you know, like I know I'll never be a Leonardo, you know, like because I'm kind of a coward.
She was just a young girl in the early 19th century. And I was a teenager getting in fights in the city. She was stuck all alone in a world full of luxury, ready to jump off the boat and throw her life away into the sea. And then she met a young man who's been in a ton of pretty good movies. My girlfriend would still sleep with him even in his 40s. He was kind of an artist, a cheesy artist, painter guy. And I was a cowardly kid, he was a brave one, willing to die. Cause he was ready when the ship went down. And I was crying in the 13th row, trying not to make a sound. Cause honestly, I would probably just freak out. Amber Young, I mean, go, go, go. I know I'll never be a Leonardo.
And so it's like, you know, I mean, it's sort of trying to portray the songwriter as not the hero, you know, in shining armor from a long time ago, but trying to be a little bit more realistic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of what I was going for in that song.
I am far from being an alpha male.
Right.
I've never been in a fight, fist fight. I've always used my words and my mouth to get me out of trouble as much as possible.
Me
I've
too.
Been hit, but I've never hit back. So
you're a better man than I am.
So in regards to this, like I get it, you know, like that feeling of just, yeah, I don't have that great dominating masculinity, but you're self-aware of it. And I think, that says a lot. And in, you know, it ends with you saying, you know, as long as you love me for how I am, that's really all that matters.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
and I think that's it. That's all that matters.
That's
yeah.
all I can, you know, that's all I can do. I would do whatever I can, you know, pray to God for a helping hand, but it's pretty shitty circumstances. I hope you understand. He was ready when the ship went down. I was crying in the 13th row, trying hard not to make a sound, 'cause honestly, I would probably just freak out. Amber yelling at me, go, go, go. I know I'll never be, but maybe that's okay if you say you love me. I know I'll never be a Leonardo.
So after the first self-titled album, you put out a couple more called 2 and 3. We stuck with like the Roman numeral theme. And you also did, you know, we've mentioned it a couple times, Broken Baby, your band with Amber. You put out several releases in that time span. And then you've been busy lately. You were putting out, what, a song a week for almost like 2 months?
Yeah, for 8 weeks. 8 songs. So yeah, 2 months exactly.
And that's what our last song is, one of these brand new songs. It was released May 8th and is called Praying for Rain. And I knew we were going to include one of the new songs. I've been loving the new songs. Are you planning on doing an IV album, or are you happy with just releasing singles now?
I don't have plans. Yeah, I don't. Okay. I don't know. There's no time for plans in this era of that we're living in. I'm done writing those songs for now. I started writing them because I felt a little powerless with all that was going on. This is obviously before, you know, the new civil rights movement, which has sort of been sparked by this, the murder of George Floyd. But it was during the beginning of the pandemic, and I felt very powerless, uniquely powerless, because I'd never obviously experienced anything like this before. Political activism is very easy for me to get engaged with, because it's part of a network of other people and other things and issues and policies that we're trying to affect. But when you're dealing with something that's a virtually unstoppable silent killer like a virus, you know, no amount of lobbying is going to prevent it from infecting you or infecting the people that you love, quite literally. So I didn't know what to do, and I felt pretty powerless. I think I started by doing some like acoustic covers of some of my songs on Instagram for people. I mean, I don't have a very big fan base, so it's not like, you know, I felt like, I need to answer the people. But I did feel, again, like if music to me is a form of activism, then I think that it would, what I can offer people is what they've heard before from me. So I kind of went to the roots of like the Damwells and some of the music, you know, like we talked about before, like, you know, Westerberg and Bob Mould and that sort of Minneapolis sound. And tried to dig back into like what would in my mind be like the follow-up Damwell's record to the self-titled one that came out in 2015. And to try to just offer that as a, because again, like I'm a hack, you know, it's not hard for me to do this. I've been doing it for a long time. I'm not saying I'm good, but I can do this.
I'll say you're good.
Well, thank you. But what I'm trying to say is that I'm not, you know, it's not hard for me to do it. It's, you know, whether or not it's any good is sort of out of my hands. I mean, I try to make it good because I'm pretty good at doing what I know how to do. So I thought that it would be, you know, something that I could do to sort of like give someone, anyone, a couple people, a dozen people even, you know, something to sort of take them out of the anxiety of where they are. And I think this became apparent to me, my that I could do this when we played the last, we played a Damwell's reunion show of sorts last year in Brooklyn. And I had this like epiphany when I was singing some of these songs where, I mean, people were going crazy, losing their minds, crying, screaming at the top of their lungs, singing along. I mean, it was like pretty wild. And I'm not saying that to try to, you know, like, you know, make it seem like, oh, wow, I should have been famous. It was more like I was in a unique position where I was offering people a real tangible taste of nostalgia. Not just nostalgia.
You were having a moment.
Right, but it wasn't just nostalgia that they feel when they listen to the music. I was able to be the, you know, the guide through some of the times of their life that they look back on with nostalgia. And I realized that is actually a very powerful thing to be able to do. And I think I understand now why a lot of bands like just keep touring forever and are perfectly happy to do so, because they understand that no one gives a shit about what they're doing now if they make a new record, right? And that's totally fine, because what they're actually supplying to people is this moment where they get to leave themselves and go back to a time when they, you know, of course it was probably not any better of a time than they're experiencing now, but the perception of it to them is filling them with joy. You know, that's really what nostalgia is. And I thought that is something that I was doing at that time, where it was like what I was saying, what the songs were about, what I was doing was irrelevant. It was just that I was there being the mouthpiece for this thing that I created a long time ago, which then had a life of its own. So I thought maybe I can do that, replicate that kind of thing by hunkering down and writing songs, doing the work. It's not hard for me to do the work. You know, I feel like I'm pretty disciplined. I can sit down and write a song. If I couldn't do that, I wouldn't be any good. So I just sat down and I wrote song after song after song after song, trying to sort of like work in this mode. And then George Floyd was killed, you know, and I had already sort of been doing some activism before that and thinking about, you know, activism, but it definitely had been put on hold because we were in the middle of this pandemic. But, you know, of course, injustice doesn't wait for the opportunity to come around. You know what I mean? It's injustice just continues. And I just felt like I'd said enough. And I worked my way back into Broken Baby. We're putting together a compilation with the record label that I run and the record label that Amber and I also own and operate. And we're putting together a compilation with, you know, a couple, I think 25 artists or something, that's coming out on Friday. And Broken Baby wrote a new song for it, which is a protest song called Weatherman. So it was like that time was over, you know. And I know it probably sounds like cold and sort of detached, but it's really about, I think, of being a songwriter as like being a carpenter in some respects, even though a carpenter is far more important than a songwriter. But I think that there's a kind of tool that we use and an effect that that tool has that can be really powerful. It's a bit invisible because you can't sit in it and you can't live in it, but it does affect people in a way that is powerful. And I totally accept that. And so I try to utilize my skills to do that, to affect change and to affect people. And that's why I say I'm kind of a retired songwriter, because I'm not going to sit down and write a song without some sort of intentional purpose to either affect change or to help someone or some, you know, group of people. And I think that's, you know, that song Praying for Rain is just sort of like my imitation of what, you know, I don't know, what John Mellencamp would be doing right now if he was my age, you know.
I tried to sing all my discontent. Nobody even did.
Yeah, it immediately has a very retro feel to it. You know, it's got like a Cars style synthesizer. I immediately thought of David Essex and the song Rock On when you kick into the chorus.
Yeah.
Because you said, hey, kid, rock and roll.
That's right.
You know, and you get those, like you said, those feelings. It's just a fun rocking song.
Thanks.
It sounds like you're singing with a sneer
Yeah. The
entire time, which as an old punk, I totally appreciate. There's like a grit and a bitterness maybe
sure.
to the vocal. And yeah, I kind of wondered, like, are you the narrator on this song, or who is supposed to be the narrator?
You know, that's a question I think a lot of songwriters get. I just don't think it's important.
Okay.
Who you know, because I think it's like, again, because I don't think of them as my stories. I sort of just think of them as songs.
Sure.
I think that we spend a lot of time propping up artists and songwriters, and even the word artist is applied to a lot of people who, you know, are undeserving of the title, I guess. I mean, you know, only because the word itself has all these connotations to it that imply that they should be lionized and elevated. I don't think that songs should be elevated beyond, you know, like what they're trying to affect or how they help affect change, you know. So I always have a problem with like the question of like, you know, is this about you? You know, is this about a story in your life? And, you know, I think you can probably hear from my voice. Like, I get far more excited when I'm talking about the craft of it or, like, what it is
Sure.
that it's trying to do as opposed to what it is. You know, because I don't really... I'm not interested in... When I listen to, like, Blowing in the Wind, like, I'm not interested in what Bob Dylan was thinking about. I'm interested in what he's telling me.
Okay.
And I think it's like it's high time for songs to start doing that again, for songs to start telling people about something, inspiring them to be motivated to change themselves or to change the things around them that they see are wrong.
What have you been listening to lately that has really grabbed your attention? Have you been listening to anything new? Or are you finding yourself going back and listening to stuff that you've, you know, maybe not paid attention to in a while and just revisiting classics?
Well, because I run a record label, I have to listen to a lot of new stuff.
Sure.
Like especially stuff from the artists on our roster. So I listen to a lot of that. I listen to a lot of bands that, like, I think that... you know, Broken Baby should be connecting with, because that's the thing too, is you can listen to bands now if you're in a band and you can connect with them almost instantly, you know, by finding them on Instagram when you're sending them a message. And, you know, we do that a lot. We try to build community around bands and songs, you know, virtual communities, I guess, although, you know, communities are sort of always virtual in some aspect, but it's, yeah, so I listen to a lot of that. I mean, some of the stuff that I'm... A great singer-songwriter, a black woman who's lives in L.A., goes by Sunny War. She's got a song on the compilation called I'm Human that's really beautiful. There's another band, you know, like a pretty, like, cool punk kind of Talking Heads-ish band from L.A. called Mod Pods that we've played with a couple times that are really great. You know, there's my buddy Lou DeFabrizio, who's in a band called Gasoline Heart. He's been putting out really cool music.
I think I know a guy in Gasoline Heart. Fortson
yeah.
plays bass. Yeah, he used to be in a band called Squad 5-0 that I used to listen to back in the day.
Yes. Yeah, and Lou is definitely, I think he was either like in that band for a while or knew all those guys. So that's like that,
okay.
that little community there too.
Cool. Well, I want to thank you for taking this time out of your day to sit down and discuss 10 of 10 of your songs, 5 favorites of yours, 5 favorites of mine, and want everybody to make sure they check out the companion Spotify playlist, of course, to listen to those songs as well as your entire catalog. Where can people find you online if they want to check out your record label or Broken Baby and what you're working on?
There's Broken Baby is all over, you know, social media and stuff. There, I think the Instagram handle is like Broken Baby Baby, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
And I, you know, if you Google Broken Baby, we're likely to come up. If you Google my name, Alex Deason, that's likely to come up. I have my own Instagram account, which I, you know, post stuff to and direct people to stuff that I'm doing. And then the Damwells is, you know, it's all like on Spotify and all that stuff. And yeah, I mean, that, I guess that's where I would direct people. I don't think anyone has a website anymore, but I'm sure there's one out there somewhere.
Yeah, they pretty much all go to Bandcamp pages and right. and stuff like that now. So
yeah,
Alex, thank you again for doing this, and I look forward to all your future songs whenever you feel inspired and have something to say. I definitely will be here listening.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Thank you again to Alex for joining me here on My Personal Mixtape. Be sure to check out the companion Spotify playlist just by typing in Alex Deason, My Personal Mixtape. If you would like to contact the show, just send an email to drunkenlullabiespodcast@yahoo.com. Next episode, I will be sitting down with Mike Holt, lead singer of the punk band The Huntingtons. Mike and I go way back, and we will have plenty to talk about. So stay tuned for that on the next episode. Our theme music is done by the band Blood Command on Hassle Records. The song is called Saturday City, and you can find that on all digital music platforms. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time.